Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're continuing our coverage of the Air Force Association's annual Airspace Cyber Conference and Trade Show, this year conducted virtually. Dave Alexander is the president of General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, the maker of the ubiquitous and game-changing Reaper and Predator aircraft, with more than 10,000 workers, most in the sunny San Diego area, but also worldwide. And I should note that General Atomics Aeronautical Systems is also sponsoring our strategy coverage. We spoke to Alexander last week before the Pentagon announced an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract valued at up to $7.4 billion for new Reaper unmanned aircraft, modifications to planes, as well as services should they be needed in the future for domestic and overseas customers. Dave, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Vago, and I'm very pleased to be on your podcast here. So thanks for having me, and it's always look forward to interesting discussions that you have. So appreciate that.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Dave. And feelings very mutual over the years. We've met at air shows around the world, and I'm sorry we're not meeting in person this year to do that. Before we get started, I just want to also mention our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage, and of course Bell sponsors this podcast. Dave, let's start with COVID. Right, everybody has been impacted by this. In fact, we're not meeting in person because of this. And everybody from government to industry are trying to use this as an opportunity to step up their game. How are you guys using this unfortunate crisis to try to either drive better effectiveness or efficiency?
Well, I think, when it first hit, we were all pretty panicked because we weren't quite sure how we were going to keep things rolling and be able to sell airplanes out of the factory. And so it was a little bit of a panic in the beginning, but quickly everybody came together. I think one of the big advantages is that, to keep our factory moving, some of the things that we've been wanting to do to automate, and like for DCMA and, intermediate sell-off points during production, kind of forced us to do this automation, if you will. And so that really pushed that in place, and things kept moving up on our flight line, as we're selling off airplanes. Likewise, our customers came together at DCMA, and we all worked it out. And, not in every day, but when they did come in, things were very efficient, and it was a real team effort. So I think that part of the, it's kind of a silver lining, if you will, on this whole pandemic. Other areas, we're deployed at 80 locations around the world, and our people are in some places where they only go in for 3 months at a time. So they're 3 months in, 3 months back, and, they repeat that. So because of the travel restrictions, we were not able to get relief out to the field. So, we had close to 60-70% of the workforce in the field that were, essentially out there almost twice as long as, their standard deployment. And if you've ever been to some of these places, it's really a 7-day, 84-hour a week job, two shifts, 12-hours each shift. So you can get burned out. So, our people are part of the warfighter, and they hung in there, and we worked really close with MilAir. And so everybody worked together, and, eventually we started getting replacement service people out into the field.
And so how many people were out there like that? I think that people don't have a tendency of knowing the kind of role the contractors play on this, and they think about the military people as opposed to the civilian contractors that actually are out there as well. Roughly how many people were out there around the world like this at these 80 locations that were?
So yeah, downrange, the CONUS and OCONUS, we have about 1,200 people. That includes our people as well as some small percentage of subcontract help as well that go with some of the specialty capabilities that we have. Now, I'd say roughly 50-60% of that is OCONUS. And it's the Oconus piece of that. So, you know, 500, 600 heads are out in the field that, you know, we're essentially stuck not being able to get replaced out there.
Well,
I'm 80 locations around the world. And you know, that really brings us close to the warfighter, I think. You know, we all pulled together, and the commanders at each site were very thankful that our people really stepped up to, you know, stay the course.
Let's talk a little bit about AFA. Virtually, obviously, Dr. Roper, the Air Force Acquisition Executive, has really been driving tectonic change. We heard that message from General C.Q. Brown, the 22nd Chief of Staff of the Air Force, sort of accelerate change or lose is his model. We have the E-Series designator now for electronic weapon systems. And Dr. Roper revealed that the next generation air dominance fighter, or at least, you know, one of those companies, competing companies, apparently, you know, not only developed this airplane electronically, but managed to actually build a flying article in about a year's time. And he said flew its actual physical test flight and did so breaking records. Walk us through how these all of these changes from the desire for digital design threads, Century Series, how is all of this going to change how you guys are interfacing with the customer, and how it builds, and how you're going to reshape your long-term strategic competitive plans as a consequence?
Well, I think, you know, a little bit of background, because, you know, we're privately held, and so our owners are very invested into bringing new capability to the warfighter. And over the last, say, 25, 26 years, you know, we've brought 23 very significant variants of aircraft to the warfighter, of which probably two-thirds of those are flying today. So, you know, we've been doing Century Series, if you really want to think about it, since the mid-90s, and we haven't stopped, and we're not going to stop, and we keep going. So, you know, if you walk back to, you know, RQ-1 and then look at where we're at today with MQ-20, that ranges from, we even go back a little bit further from the NAT days, GNAT, which was, you know, about a 750-pound long endurance aircraft that we sold to Turkey in the mid-90s, or all the way to till today, MQ-20 Avenger, which is a 20,000-pound gross takeoff aircraft. So all along the way, we've innovated and, you know, kept up with what we believe is technology and, you know, new capability. Now, that being said, so we're all about, you know, bring the future faster and, you know, accelerate. And that's what we've been doing. I would say the new part of this is the Advanced Battle Management Systems Joint All Domain Command and Control, ABMS, JADC2, which I think is probably most of what that Dr. Roper presentation was about yesterday. And that's really, you know, making everything one, okay, connecting everything together. And so that's the part now that, you know, it's a new architecture. And quite honestly, it's for us, it's very easy to have what you call open OFP and OMS. That's simply an avionics box with some cables on a bracket and software mounted in our aircraft. And once you've done that, now you can bring in the autonomous code that the government owns and wants to have everybody use the same executable, and so that they're not recreating a wheel every time they turn around with a different aircraft. And so that allows us to do that. It allows us to do open architecture with payloads. And that allow us to connect into the future for the Air Force. So that's low-hanging fruit for us. Right. And an example, one of our concepts right now is called Defender, but we are flying Defender this year with this open OFP. And we're taking one airplane, live aircraft flight with the open OFP, flying the government autonomous code, connected to virtual other 6DOF, five other similar airplanes, flying a mesh network. to simulate really this future vision that Dr. Roper has. So we're all over it, and it's right in our wheelhouse of our DNA, which is we've been doing Century Series for 20, 25 years, and we're not going to stop.
And so let me ask you about that, right? I mean, you mentioned the privately held nature of the company that, in fact, has made it a little bit easier for you guys to do that, right? I mean, invest for the long term. And anybody who knows Neil Blue knows that that's one of the driving passions, right? Skate, look far into the future and skate to where you think that puck is going to be. And you mentioned you guys have steadily worked up the food chain. I mean, as somebody who started covering unmanned vehicles in the you know, extremely early 90s, you know, it went from Nat to Predator to Reaper, Gray Eagle, right? You mentioned Avenger, now Defender. MQ-25 was a very substantial airplane, and an airplane the Navy leaders did think was you know, a very, very good capability. But from your guys' perspective, unfortunately, you guys lost to Boeing, where it was seen that they could do scale production maybe a little bit better than you can. And you were one of the four companies moving ahead in the Air Force's Skyborg competition. At a time when the Pentagon wants as much competition as possible, how high up the food chain do you think you guys can go? How much larger aircraft can you develop? And would you even be interested in getting into the pointy end aircraft side of the business? I mean, where do you see your role going as you guys look 5, 10, 15, 20 years downstream?
Maybe to answer the pointy end. So, you know, we have some new technologies coming online that are advanced sensing, let's just say that. And we believe that advanced sensing is in a disaggregated mode is really the answer for airborne early warning, okay, of the future. So now you can imagine this advanced sensing meshed into many aircraft, all sensing very long distances, and this mesh is providing positions and angles such that you're getting you're able to track down to target quality. So this is a huge, huge, you know, piece of technology for us that I think will bring new capability. And that can be picked up and put into several platforms. So I mentioned Defender. Also, you know, there's RFI just came out for MQ Next. And again, that's, you know, the next step in where we're going. We're also working on the Skyborg attritables in the ABMS program as well.
Does being privately held make all this easier?
Oh, it does. Absolutely. You know, our owners have a vision and they invest right back into the company. And, you know, that's really how MQ-9B, MQ-9, you know, all those have come about. And if you're familiar with MQ-9B, you know, that's our certifiable MQ-9. It looks similar to MQ-9, but it's really a, you know, a much different aircraft, all weather, lightning protection, de-ice. It's designed to integrate into the airspace with a sense and avoid and due regard radar. And its performance is such that it can launch in recovery through SATCOM automatic takeoff and landing off 3,000 foot runways. So that's a huge, huge new capability. And the UK Protector is our launch customer. And we also have Belgian on board and then many, many international FMS sales right behind it.
So let me ask you about sort of the strategic outlook, not just for these newer platforms that you've been investing in and developing, but also the older generation platforms, whether they're Predators or Gray Eagles that are out there. It was a tremendous product line. I mean, I remember being in San Diego very early in this when you were just gearing up. I believe Chris Ames gave me a great tour when you guys were just gearing up to go 24/7. You guys couldn't hire qualified people fast enough in order to be able to deliver the demand you guys had. Obviously, you've had to more recently adjust your workforce accordingly with a 6% reduction. But if you look at it, there are some who argue that, you know, that the existing product line was, you know, unsurvivable and for an uncontested era and suited for Iraq and Afghanistan. Whereas there are other strategists who look at the platforms and say, well, wait a minute, you know, survivability was never a requirement at the time over Iraq and Afghanistan, and that modifications can be made. And in fact, it can be a force multiplier in a contested environment, whether to provide comms links, whether to provide persistent surveillance, in order to be able to extend the range of anti-submarine forces, whether surface or air breathing. Talk to us a little bit about what it would take to actually repurpose existing aircraft in order to make them more suited for an era of great power competition.
Yeah, I mean, that's the exact point. MQ-9, we believe, has a mission in the National Defense Strategy. No, it's not flying in, you know, desert areas, you know, with full motion video focused on a house or something. But, you know, with different sensors, with self-protection pods that are, you know, high TRL off the shelf, and operating, you know, phase zero, gray zone, which is, you know, an operation mode that you're going to be in for tens of years. It's not a high conflict. High conflict is days or weeks at most. So you don't want to be flying silver bullets around during phase zero in the gray zone. That doesn't make sense. And you can deter by persistence. And so it's really self-protection pods when you need them on MQ-9. It's a standoff from a in this gray zone with very long range strategic sensors that can reach in line of sight, you know, to the horizon. And so you have long reach, you're safe via standoff. If you're not quite sure the depth of a pop-up threat, and then you have self-protection pods, and you're in a cost zone of, you know, that's attrition tolerant. So I think all those things together will, you know, and there's some resilient communication changes and things like that, but not getting into all the details, this is all low hanging fruit for this platform, you know, and the Air Force has, what, 315 of these that, you know, can be reconfigured into this multi-domain operations, if you will, and provide that persistence that gives deterrence. And save your silver bullets for penetrating ISR and things like that. Army, let me just add, the Army, went through the same thing. Gray Eagle, extended range, it's no good, it'll die, blah, you know, the whole thing. And we worked with them. We took our capital aircraft and turned it into a multi-domain solution with SIGINT and COMET and long-range radar. And hooked that up into many demos for them, and then using air-launched effects, which are basically small UAS launched off the Gray Eagle, to go do eyes on target ID, and that whole, you know, standoff, stay safe, resilient comms, reach in, and the Army has adopted that as well. And I really think that whole construct plays on MQ-9 as well. Thanks for letting me get on my soapbox there. So,
No, not at all. So, I mean, do you have anything like that now with the Air Force or even the Navy? Because, for example, you know, the ability to put sonar buoys in places, right? I mean, it doesn't necessarily only have to come off of a P-8 or a helicopter. There are ways to actually broaden your ASW screen in many respects. I know that Brian Clark has had that in some of his work. He's now at the Hudson Institute. Do you have the other services now, you know, sort of actively under contract or asking you guys to investigate some of these options on how to best use? Right. I mean, a friend of mine and I this morning were talking about World War II. And in World War II, you know, swordfish biplane torpedo bombers that were seen as outmoded were actually fitted with radars. And because of their short takeoff and landing speeds, were actually an ideal aerial radar platform to hunt for submarines and stuff like that. Right. I mean, so sometimes you've got a solution that's sitting under your nose that may seem a little unconventional.
So one example would be we have a leasing program. This is where we own the aircraft and operate them and just provide the, the data for the PID. We call that company owned, company operated, or COCO, you may have heard in the past. Mm-hmm. So we have six leasing programs going on right now. But one of them is operating in USAFE. And it has one of these strategic EW long-range sensor pods on it, and it's vacuuming up all kinds of good data as we speak. And so that's another example of, a new mission for a very, very reliable, low-cost, long-endurance platform. And we're doing it. Actually, we're doing it right now as we're talking on the phone. We're collecting that data. And then you mentioned maritime, which is a whole frontier that's we're just breaking into. And so in about a week, we're going to be deploying to Japan for a multi-week demonstration for the Coast Guard. And that's a whole maritime there. And we've got, a surface search radar on the center line of the airplane, combined with automatic identification. And then that all comes down to the ground station. We have artificial intelligence that takes all those tracks. It takes hundreds and hundreds of these ship tracks and gets them down into maybe a dozen or two dozen through the AI so that you can figure out which ones are doing funny, ship to ship transfers or zigzag patterns or it says it's a pleasure boat and it's, 80 feet long with all kinds of antennas on it. So those kind of things. So that's happening as we speak. And we also have another leasing program that's doing the same thing in another part of the country for maritime. And that will be shipping out in November. So this maritime thing, I think, is a big frontier for the program. And MQ-9, especially MQ-9B with all weather, is just perfectly suited for this. Another interesting thing is we have sonobuoy dispensing pods. And so that testing will be going on, in about 2 months from now, and we'll be dispensing sonobuoys off of Point Magoo. And I forgot to mention we'll be receiving sonobuoys over in Japan as well. So anyway, that we're really moving out in this area. We call this we have Sky Guardian, which is our MQ-9B program, and then the maritime equipped version is called Sea Guardian. Just when you hear that, that's really Sky Guardian or MQ-9B equipped with modular maritime equipment, sensors and right. Sonobuoys.
And earlier I was laughing a little bit, when you said a sailboat with sensors on it, that's a little bit like those houses in Scandinavia that Russian guys were owning that were bristling with antennas and sensor equipment that were busted last year or the year before. Anyway, let me ask you, two other questions, because I know our time is running short on this. Very briefly, how big do you think the Defender market is going to be? I mean, is that a couple of hundred airplanes? Is it dozens of airplanes? I mean, how do you project that market, given that you've sort of re-engineered it for sort of more current requirements, sort of more out of the box? Like, what do you foresee that market being like?
Well, right now the market's all international, except there might be some domestic on that still in the works, but it's mostly international. And optimistically, it's over 300 airplanes. I would say realistically, maybe low 200s, maybe. So somewhere in that range. Okay.
And is the domestic customer sort of DHS ICE kind of application at the end of the day, or is it for climatological or
We have some of that going on, but no, this is for a customer that's kind of close hold right now. And when it gets a little more final, I think we would be comfortable of, but it's a major service.
So. Let me ask you two questions. One, you know, you guys really are known as, you know, the military provider worldwide, but talk to us about a little bit about how you guys see the commercial market evolving, because you know, there are a couple of hundred now urban air mobility folks who are involved in this. Bell, who's you know, obviously who sponsors this podcast series, is playing in that market, but you find companies across the board, including some really, I don't want to say fly by night, right, but it's, you know, somebody maybe with a slide deck and a little bit of money behind them. How do you guys perceive opportunities in the commercial market, whether it's for urban air mobility, whether it's for cargo transportation? How do you see that market evolving and how you guys could potentially play in it?
Well, I would say, you know, the future is bright for unmanned, you know, going forward, obviously. But for commercial application, we've looked at this a lot. I would say the cargo opportunity is probably where it's going to go first. You know, maybe it starts out with a small single or twin turboprop doing short feeder type operations, and maybe that's even something the military would be interested. But if you could take a, say, unmanned systems right out of MQ-9, just rip the systems out and bolt them into a a FAR Part 23 aircraft, I think that's pretty easy go do. You know, there's some regulatory things that we have to go work on, obviously, if you're going to do that in congested areas. But in a battlefield, you could, you know, you could take a fairly inexpensive small-sized aircraft, you know, below 18,000 pounds, and actually move some, you know, easily move some cargo around. And then beyond that, I think a purposely designed aircraft for e-commerce that has a high volume fuselage for its weight, meaning the airplane might look funny because the fuselage is bigger than, you know, what you would see for a passenger airplane that's converted over to, you know, cargo, which is what they all are today. But if you had a purposely designed platform, you know, I can see where you could have operational savings that are significant into the, you know, 30 to 50% savings, depending on what you're comparing it to. Again, it's e-commerce. Everything's got bubble wrap on it. That's where the world is going. You know, by the time they put that into the little containers and fill them all up, it's not that heavy, right?
Right.
But it's a lot of volume. And I think that's out there. You know,
30 seconds is a lot of time, especially in an interview. And I know that that's about how much time we've got left, playing off of an old joke that's between us. For decades, the missile technology control regime has been an impediment to unmanned aircraft sales. Obviously, when it was designed in the late 1980s, it was to limit the proliferation of cruise missiles effectively, right? Anything with a payload of more than 500 kilograms, about 1,100 pounds, and a range of 300 kilometers or 190 miles. Whereas now, that's matter of course for almost any unmanned system. It's certainly been a challenge for you guys overseas to go through that process in the United States to get cleared, including to some of our closest allies and partners. Folks are recognizing that this regime may not be the right regime for the future. Talk to us about how policymakers need to think about the space, think about the existing technology in it, to actually design a regulatory framework that makes more sense. And in the context of that, what would a change in the MTCR mean for your international sales outlook, especially given that that's become a challenge, again, for some close allies and partners who haven't been able to get the American capability either for MTCR or other reasons, and acquired capability from potential adversaries as a consequence.
Yeah. So just one thing quick, you know, what did change was the export policy for unmanned aircraft systems. And that change has really opened the doors for us, I think. So instead of just saying no, you know, it's like, well, we got to say why we're saying no, you know. So I think the export policy has really helped. So this administration, you know, has helped us out tremendously. And then the MTCR, you know, they're airplanes. They're not cruise missiles. This is crazy, you know. And I can remember doing a DCS sale on MQ-1 before even people tied unmanned aircraft to that, you know, policy. So I think everybody's starting to recognize that. The problem is to change that policy. You know, I don't know how many countries there are, but they all got to agree. They all got to, you know, agree to the change or nothing changes. So, you know, with all the bureaucrat, you can imagine nothing's going to get changed here. But what is being proposed is to try and differentiate unmanned aircraft out of there and doing that by airspeed. So it'd be an airspeed add to that. That would help because there's politics here. And now the politics are hanging their hat on the MTCR, even though the export policy has changed. They're still hanging their hat, I think, some of the politicians. And, you know, when you're trying to get something approved, everybody's got to get it approved. So it's not where we want to be, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was, I guess is all I'm saying. And that's our future. So this is really key to us is MTCR and understanding that these are airplanes that are remotely piloted. The only difference is it's just the pilots on the ground. They're not cruise missiles.
And international sales forecast, it's a highly competitive market. Where do you guys see playing in that market and some of the opportunities you see, not just for Defender, but beyond?
Well, it's really, really competitive. And when you slow it down with all this overhead of, you know, approvals, it's just, if you're going to let these Chinese unmanned aircraft in there and you're giving the market away, our allies are going to get tired. Our allies and partners are just going to get tired of waiting. They're going to go to China. And once China's got in there and they got their logistics trail buried in, and, you know, you're in there for 20, 30 years. So you've lost the market. So it's not something you can, it's game changing right now. It's not something, well, we'll think about it later. Later, you're done. You know, you've set the foundation for the future by not getting on this now. Really important. We need this. We need to move it quick. It's important for our allies, you know, to have our hardware.
Dave, thanks very, very much. You've been generous with your time. I know we've gone a couple of minutes over. Really appreciate it. Thanks very much again, and always a pleasure talking to you. All the very best to the team out there, and hope you guys stay well, and look forward to one of these days visiting again and seeing you guys out there in sunny San Diego. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Bob. It's really nice talking to you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.